40 years ago, police officers in Bihar's Bhagalpur dropped acid into the eyes of 33 men they'd accused of various violent crimes. Local judges ignored the parade of maimed prisoners. Jail authorities pretended nothing was going on. The public mostly cheered. Though the Supreme Court eventually stepped in, subsequent prosecutions collapsed for lack of evidence. Last week, we had the alleged extrajudicial execution of four men alleged to have raped a Hyderabad woman. People celebrated on the streets. There's clearly something about this story which needs more than moral judgment. It tells us something profoundly disturbing about us as a people and the state of our republic. I'm Praveen Swamy, and for this week's Distilled podcast from First Post, I'm speaking to the historian and philosopher Dilip Simeon on what justice means in India today and what the difference is between justice and vengeance. In Dilip Simeon's view, the death penalty isn't just something hangmen hand out for the state. It's part of the fabric of our society, used by everyone from participants in communal lynch mobs to Maoists and jihadis. It is the outcome of a polity where there's no agreement on the most basic values, nor legitimate instruments to mediate conflicts. Put another way, the death penalty is the point at which democracy and everything we value about it disappears.
Every few years, these sort of moments of bloodlust and frenzy erupt on our streets, where you have very large numbers of people celebrating, maiming, killing. Yeah. And this isn't new, is it, in India? I mean, we always view it with a certain shock, which we should. But all the way back to the Bhagalpur blindings and even earlier, the use of savagery as an instrument to punish purported evildoers has quite an old history in this country, doesn't it?
Let's remember first that our population is accustomed to savagery. If you look at the scale of the communal violence and genocidal activities going on, we must remember that some degree of savagery has become, people have become accustomed to it. And remember also that this kind of savagery is interpreted in the minds of people as some primitive form of justice.
What do we mean when we talk of justice? This word is widely invoked.
That's a debate that has been going on now for 25 centuries, I mean, or more. I mean, Plato's Republic is all about justice. And I must confess, it's difficult for me to crack that nut so easily. But let me just say that from the very beginning, people have felt that there's something divine about justice. So Immanuel Kant said, for instance, that if the world is deprived of justice, if justice disappears, then human life on earth will lose its meaning, purposiveness. This is exemplified in the very fact that you take an oath when you get into a court of justice. You're supposed to take an oath on that which you consider most sacred. So justice, therefore, is very crucial for any polis or polity to run itself. It has been variously defined in terms of giving people their just deserts, or giving, or everybody minding his own business, or giving recompense when there is some harm done, etc., etc. So it's very complex. But let's just say that it's got something to do with fairness. Fairness and a fair treatment of people in accordance with what is deemed to be proper and not proper.
And how do we distinguish this sort of shifting, changing thing we call justice from vengeance? Because when people call, for example, for the castration of rapists or the maiming of people, or it's not always whether they're talking about vengeance of one kind or whether they are talking about justice, and whether in fact there is a distinction in their minds between these two things.
Yes, that's a very, very important issue. I think the question of some kind of retribution and recompense is involved in justice. However, wisdom is not the same thing as recompense. I mean, for instance, even today, the CJI has said that revenge ought not to come into justice.
Right. So
obviously, therefore, the wise have known for a long time that justice is not simply about revenge, although some element of recompense and retribution is involved in it. I think that if we go more closely into it, you find that prior to or antecedent to the requirement of retribution is the requirement of acknowledgement of wrongdoing. In fact, so often does it happen that even the mere acknowledgement that you have done something wrong removes the bite from the wrongdoing and allows the injured party to consider mercy or consider To mute their desire.
Right, and that's something we find even in our everyday lives, where a neighbor may come and apologize for parking badly, and we say, fine, that's the end of
it. So there, that links up to, say, Aristotle's theory of friendship, where he says friendship actually obviates the need for justice altogether. So it's very interesting. Yeah, so if friendship can obviate the need for justice, it means that there's something about acknowledgement and friendly communication which allows us to live with the wrongdoing and unfairness in society without getting overly bothered about revenge. It's only when there is no sign of acknowledgement, there is no sign that anybody is accepting that some wrong has been done, that it leads to bitterness.
In India, we haven't really had a successful tradition of punishment for wrongdoing. So if I look back to the Bhagalpur blindings, which I'd mentioned earlier, they were widely applauded locally because people feel some right was being done.
Yeah.
Criminals were being punished. We've had giant riots with hundreds, even thousands killed, where no perpetrator has been ever punished for anything. And of course, such criminality is routine in our streets and our homes on an everyday basis. To what extent is this sort of call for some sort of savagery or whatever, in fact, a call of despair that you have a society with no justice and therefore something drastic and terrible must be done?
I think this is a very important issue which we have to face, that our society only pretends to be civilized. Actually, there are deep roots of barbarism and savagery running in our society, right up to the topmost levels of society. And that this despair, this spontaneous attraction towards immediate action and revenge and so on. This is the root of vigilantism.
Right.
And it's also due to the fact that justice is weak. Max Horkheimer sometimes said that the longevity or the stamina of theology is based upon, arises from the weakness of justice and the vagaries of fate. So justice is weak. Therefore, you believe in God as a means of convincing yourself that the murderer will not ultimately go scot-free. At least God will punish him. So there is an element of desperation and lack of belief in the fairness of the system. And let's remember, even Mahatma Gandhi did not get justice. He was murdered, and the chief perpetrator of the murder, the chief conspirator, is now hailed as a great hero. So this is a condition of justice in our country. So this is one issue, one reason for this. Even in the recent incidents, you find people hailing the actions of the Telangana police and Andhra police, whatever it is. But if you go even a little back into this particular incident, or even the recent incidents of what's happening in UP and all, you'll find that the police actually, by their inaction in the proper time, they allowed the crime to happen and or allowed the crime to take away the life of the person. After which then the people begin baying for blood. But had the police acted in time, and in fact, I'm being mild, many times women who have been raped or molested, when they go to the police,
the same
happens to them. The second issue is that what you're talking about, mass violence and so on, there is an element of genocidal complicity. When large numbers of people get involved in a crime, it's very difficult to figure out who is responsible. So you get freedom, you get safety in numbers. And as a result, you have many cases of mass violence in which it is absolutely impossible to actually pin the blame on anybody. And of course, where everybody is to blame, nobody is to blame. So this is what we are confronted with. We are confronted with a complete breakdown of the civil respect for law and justice. And that is compounded by the fact that the people who are in charge of it are not doing their job.
This question of a civil breakdown sort of rests on the idea that at one point we had a functioning civil society with institutions that functioned in some kind of norm-based way. But that's not really true, is it? I mean, this was a nation born of partition, which was a set of enormous crimes for which nobody was ever punished. And we've had that at quite regular intervals before. Does that mean our democratic being, as it were, is just a fiction, is only skin deep?
It would be realistic to admit that the formation of a civil space or a public space or civil society, as it were, in our country is a slow and tortuous process, which has often been interrupted by this savagery and by all kind of ideological inflections in which or identity politics, in which your guilt does not arise from what you have done, but from what you are. Guilt or innocence is decided upon what you are rather than what you have done. That's what identity politics means. The problem is that our civil society has not fully developed. It has had a very tortuous history. There were times in the past when it was slowly developing. Then it was engulfed by all kinds of very vicious ideologies in which basically violence was being encouraged. And violence of a certain kind was considered to be legitimate response to the violence of another kind emanating from other side. In short, our civil society has been infected by what I would call agonistic speech.
Can you explain that a little bit?
The word agon is from the ancient Greece. And the agon meant the contest between two individuals. It could be a verbal contest or it could even be an athletic contest. It was characterized by a binary antagonism. So the word agon is the word from, is the root of the word antagonist, protagonist.
Right. See,
so this agonistic speech is speech in which basically, to put it in simple language, everything is conducted as if we were in an undergraduate debating competition.
And of course, one of the features of an undergraduate debating competition is that only one side wins.
Yes. So agonistic speech is not a conversation. It's a contest, it's a competition, and it increasingly becomes binary and increasingly becomes reduced to either or instead of both and. Either or is one way of looking at the exploration for truth. Both and is a more efficient way of looking for truth. It's a dialogic way. It admits that there may be something in both sides and we have to transcend it and rise beyond it and so on. So this agonistic speech is what we have been indulging in. The most easy example of agonistic speech is to take a look at debate TV today.
Right.
It's a form of silence. I say that ideological speech is a form of silence. It's not silence in auditory sense. It's a silence in the semantic sense.
So one of the stories I have has actually to do with you. We were on a TV panel together and the anchor asked me to condemn you as a Maoist. And when I said, actually, somewhat startled that you were not a Maoist, he never asked me a question again subsequently.
Oh, okay, I forgot. Because I know that. I was a Maoist, then I stopped being a Maoist. And that was 30 years ago, and now it's 45 years ago. Huh? So don't please label me like this, because I've been criticizing Maoism and Maoist violence for 4 decades. So what the hell do you mean I'm a Maoist sympathizer? So this is they are comfortable reducing people by means of sticking labels on them and reducing them to one camp or the other camp. This is the end of philosophical speech. That's what I mean. There's a philosopher I deeply respect who says that nihilism is a state of affairs in which speech is equivalent to silence. In short, whether you speak or do not speak, nobody is listening.
I want to come back to this point you made about the police and our dysfunctional policing. Now, the police are, of course, a tool that a society uses to enforce certain norms, and it's one of many tools that we have. One of the odd things is that while lamenting the fact that we have such awful policing in this country, we're all beneficiaries of it in one way or the other. For example, if I'm pulled over at a red light, it's much more convenient to pay the constable 500 rupees
yes.
than go through an elaborate legal process.
Yes.
And as a journalist, one of the more amusing things for me has often been how friends who will condemn police torture wanted to be deployed instantly on the parking attendant the minute their car is stolen, for example. Why do we have this reluctance as a society to be bound by shared norms? Is it that is that class, this privilege and entitlement, or is it a larger failure to transition towards modernity?
Well, the thing is, that's a big issue. This is a hard old chestnut, because modernity incorporates all these pre-existent unevennesses and all that. It incorporates it, but we'll leave that aside. The fact is, yes, there is an expectation in our society, which you call entitlement, that people of different castes and different classes and backgrounds will be treated in different ways, differential ways. So this differential treatment is the expectation and knowledge of everybody. Everybody knows this is what happens. If you even look at a traffic signal, I remember years ago noticing this, that the police fellow in charge of at the red light, if there was a car owner who broke the red light, then there may or may not be an altercation, and of course it would end with a bribe or something. But if there was a poor rickshaw puller or a ferrule cycle, the police wala will pull out his valkyrie.
Right, or he will get a thrashing.
All in a pitai ko jai. So this issue of differential treatment is a very old issue. Radhika Singha has written a whole book on colonial law, which is called The Despotism of Law, where she describes how in Banaras, if you were a Brahmin and murdered someone, then at best you could get tonsured and expelled from the city. But if you were of a lower caste and murdered someone, then you would be given more rigorous punishment, etc. So there were differential punishments depending on who you were, meaning that somehow or the other it was accepted in India that who you are determines the level of criminality that you have indulged in, even if it is a terrible crime.
Right, and you have that even with modern death penalty debates, for example. You have an extraordinary judgment in the Graham Staines case saying because this man was a missionary, therefore it was somehow understandable that the perpetrators...
people were furious with him. Yes, I wrote a whole article on this.
I remember that.
And I remember pointing out something which nobody... It took me time to even explain to somebody what I was trying to say. I said, there were three people killed there, not just one.
The two children were not proselytizing
Christianity. So when you are even discussing this debate, debating this issue, you confine yourself to Graham Staines and what he was or was not doing. You refrain from even discussing the question of the culpability of the two children, what if the father was doing. In short, this is transfer of intergenerational transfer of guilt.
Which is something to do with caste, surely, doesn't it?
It has something to do with caste. It's something to do with what we call communalism. Communalism, which goes back, I mean, anti-Semitism is one of the oldest forms of communalism. Where in the Bible, according to the Gospel, according to Matthew, the Jews claimed to have owned the murder of Christ. His blood be on our head and of our children. These are famous lines from the Gospel according to Matthew. Right? His blood be on our head and of our children, in response to Pontius Pilate saying, I find no guilt in this man, do with him as you will. Then they said, we own the guilt. What does this mean? This means that an entire community and all their children for generations are responsible for something done at one given moment of time. So this way, this is communal thinking. This communal thinking is not just confined to Christian anti-Semitism. It's there even when we say Babar ki aulad. What do you mean Babar ki aulad? You mean everything that Babar did is devolves around everything.
You're obviously not discussing Babar's DNA test.
Yes, precisely. Yeah. Precisely. We are saying that an entire community, like we say, the six killed Indira Gandhi. Say six did not kill Indira Gandhi, two six killed Indira Gandhi. How can you blame all the six for that? What two six did? But this is the way our society thinks.
And it goes down to the bottom. So if you speak to villagers, they will often say, Gujaro ne ye kiya, ya Jato ne ye kiya.
Correct. So this community, this tribal identity, communal identity, which we have fashioned and not gotten out of, there is a conflict in India between the sense of the individual and the sense of belonging to a community. This conflict, this is a part of our civil fabric, our mental fabric, our cultural fabric, and we have not yet developed to the point where we can see beyond it.
Coming to the death penalty, which is, something that is now being touted increasingly as a solution for so many of our problems, whatever they are. I'm intrigued by why people have this durable faith in it. Every piece of social science data we have tells us that the death penalty does not deter criminals. So Iran, for example, executes drug peddlers by the sackful every month, and yet has one of the highest heroin addiction rates in the entire region. In the US and in Canada, where they've experimented with various death penalty regimes, rates of murder go up, down, whatever, irrespective of what rate they have in mind. What is it with us that we see this idea that killing someone will somehow solve all our problems in a magical way? Does this come from mythology or from culture or what is it?
I don't think it comes from something far simpler. It comes from a desire for revenge and retribution. It's simply douses the immediate anger and the psychic desire for immediate retribution. That's all it does. People are not rational beings. People don't think about what will happen in the future. Will this wipe out crime? Will this wipe out heroin addiction? Will it wipe out serial killing? No, they're not interested in these issues. Haven't you noticed enough to see that people are not rational? They don't think rationally. They think emotionally. The whole point in philosophy is to somehow combine the passions and reason, somehow try to overcome this division. But most people are not busy studying Plato and Hegel and Hobbes. They're just interested in getting immediate recompense or immediately assuaging their sense of hurt and anger and so on. That's what happens in a riot. But before I proceed on this issue, because it's a very interesting question you've asked, let me also remind you that the police and its activity, so they doctor the evidence beforehand. So when you go to register an FIR, a poor man when he's registering the FIR cannot see what the policeman is writing. The policeman can easily fudge the record in such a manner that the ultimate trial will fall to the ground. This is what happened in the Pehlu Khan case.
Right.
You have a videograph of a murder going on, and yet nobody is convicted. Everybody is let off. This is because the police are in cahoots with the criminals beforehand. So this leads to the utter despair.
But here is the funny part of the story. Mm. If you ask any average Indian whether they trust the police, I doubt you're going to get a lot of people standing up and saying, yes, we think these are paragons of honesty and morals. There isn't an Indian without an unhappy story to tell about a dishonest cop or bribe-seeking or so on. Yet when they shoot someone, suddenly these are very fine, upstanding people. And I have to say this confuses me.
It doesn't confuse me at all. It's simply that they project their anger on the criminals through and via the police. The police then becomes an agency through which they are actually mediating their anger and hate and violent rage. Instead of they themselves engaging in a lynching, the police has done the lynching for them. People who are violating the law benefit from the violation of the law and use the position that they have gained thereby. Further sabotage.
Right, and this is true not only of hate speech, but everything from land grabbing to illegal construction.
Sand mining, everything. Mass murder. That's why it's important to have independent prosecution, to have some independence of the police, to have a situation where there is a separation of powers. Separation of powers is very crucial in a liberal democracy. What is happening now is gradually the separation of powers, which people have won at great cost, is being demolished in front of our eyes. People don't realize it. When this Lokpal debate was going on, interestingly, nobody has talked of Lokpal. They made a big halla about Lokpal.
And it's
Lokpal
gone.
Disappeared from public view. I remember talking to some people in a college lecture, and I said that, look, it's taken centuries to arrive at the notion of separation of powers. A singular authority is wont to veer in the direction of tyranny. If you separate powers and give adequate authority to those separated bodies of the government and executive, then you have some safeguards. You want to abolish all this and give supreme power to someone called a Lokpal, in which every branch of government will come under the control of one person. This is wrong. This is the root cause of a lot of degeneration.
And ultimately, neither does the police or the bureaucracy. Everything, power stems
precisely,
effectively, a Mughal era ruler.
Yes, the abolition of the distinction between legal violence and illegal violence. That's the root of a lot of problems. Legal violence is violence authorized, duly authorized by and delegated to a legitimate authority, where you can then legitimately act against wrongdoing. Illegal violence is vigilantism.
Right.
And illegal violence grows in an atmosphere where the law and order system is failing. So even Maoists in that sense are indulging in a pursuit of justice by doing vigilante violence. So the vigilante violence of Hindutva groups or vigilante violence of Maoists or jihadists is all the same. They're all different kinds of pursuit of justice in the name of some
higher cause,
self-authorized sort of legitimacy, which you can question, but they strongly believe in it. That's the power of ideology. Ideology gives people the illusion of understanding more than they actually know. And this situation, they feel so convinced of their superior knowledge on the one and their good intentions. So you will find this kind of statement occurring even in the trial of Aurobindo Ghosh and Bindra Ghosh in the 1900s when Chittaranjan Das appeared for them. And he said, my client, the Maniktola conspiracy case, my client is not up for trial before this bar. He's up for trial before the bar of history.
I cannot be judged by the standards of ordinary mortals or my peers.
In short, you cannot be judged by anybody because history is not an old man with a long beard sitting somewhere over the horizon. You'll never reach there.
So Nietzsche would have approved deeply of Indians.
I don't know. So I think that we still have a very primitive idea of justice. We have not given thought to it. The leaders of society, the intellectual leaders of society who ought to have been devoting themselves to this issue have not done so. The people in power and political power, many, many of them are people who themselves have committed crimes. This shows that in our society, we have not really developed a sense, or a civic sense, or even of the value of justice. The value of justice, they don't realize. See, if people who are very powerful engage in or encourage violence, it simply means that they do not realize how important justice is even to their continued rule. Some elements of the bourgeoisie are realizing that now. To have even big-time corporates tell the Home Minister that, you know, we are troubled about lynching. After all, what is about some poor cattle trader?
Yeah, I mean, why should some big company care?
Why you bother? But you do bother some of them who are discerning enough, and I respect them. I don't want to condemn everybody for being bourgeois. I respect them and hail the fact that they have said this.
No, and you've certainly seen the costs.
Yeah.
Where, say, a state like Haryana, one of our economic powerhouses, implodes in a matter of hours along caste lines where the police and every other institution sees
the
work.
Yes, correct. So the justice, therefore, is important in order to keep the veins and skeins of society together. There is a line out of Bhagavad Gita, I forget, I can't quote exactly where or in Sanskrit, but the disinterestedly wise strive to maintain the integrity of all being. Wise strive for the integrity of all being.
That's a fantastic line because that gets to the heart of it.
Yes. So therefore, if you are wise, you will see that it is the interest of the whole of society that justice be maintained, because justice must not only be implemented, it must be seen to be fair.
A final question, Dilip, because we're almost out of time now.
No, it's all right. Carry on.
All of this has been agitated at various points in the past. And the emergency was supposed to be the great moment of crisis in our democracy, where many of these things came to a head and were overcome by a democratic move. And we were supposed to have understood the importance of institution, of restraints, on power, and to be wary of tyranny. You were a part of what happened after that. What went wrong?
I think there's a very, very interesting citation from George Orwell, Road to Wigan Pier, where he visited the poor areas of England in 1934. This is before Nazism actually, the Second World War broke out. He has a whole chapter on socialists. And he, as you know, he himself was a socialist. He said the problem with the socialists is that they are always sawing off the branch on which they're sitting. This in a nutshell is my answer to your question, which is a very important question which I have been dealing with for the last four decades. That they forgot, he said, the socialists forgot that socialism is about justice and liberty. They focus only on the material aspect and the economic aspect, thereby handing over the philosophical issues of justice and liberty to the right wing. Because man does not live by bread alone. Don't reduce...
People will sacrifice bread quite willingly for larger ends.
Precisely. Having been part of the communist movement and the Maoist and Naxalite movement, I realized for years and years I've been saying this. Defend democracy. Defend the constitution. It doesn't matter whether it's Hindutva ideology, jihadist ideology, or Stalinist ideology, or Maoist ideology. The rule of an ideology means the end of human speech. That's why fighting for justice is the crux of the matter. And death penalty is not going to cut it.
The killings in Hyderabad weren't the first extrajudicial murders India's seen, nor the largest, nor even the most savage. The spectacle of hundreds of thousands of Indians cheering cold-blooded murder is, however, new. It isn't hard to understand the frustrations and social disintegration that drive support for the death penalty. But the path we've walked on for so long, it should now be clear, leads only to the abyss.